Coming up on Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, we're talking about a new way to look at multiple sclerosis with Dr. Angelique Porthals. That's up next on Dr. Kiki's Science Hour.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with me, Dr. Kiki. Episode number 130, recorded Thursday, January 26th, 2012, An Inflammatory Revolution. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. We are just ratcheting up the numbers week by week. Another episode, more science. Can't believe 130 hours of science are in the archives now. This is our 130th hour of science that we're bringing to life. Conversation week after week here on the show. You know you can count on a topic that's really interesting with an expert in that area to talk about it for the entire hour. That's what I do here, right? That's why you love the show. Tell your friends. You know you want to. Share Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with those you love. That's right. Science is good for them. I hope you're ready because we have another great show lined up for you today. I hope you're ready to dig in, get dirty with the science because it's a really interesting subject. We're going to get talking about the science of the immune system and specifically the disease called multiple sclerosis with our guest, Dr. Angelique Porthals from SUNY, John Jay College for Criminal Justice in New York City. But first, before we jump into the conversation, I have a few science headlines. A panel of court-approved scientists concluded that children under 5 living near the West Virginia DuPont chemical plant are more likely to be exposed to and have higher levels of the industrial chemical perfluorooctanoate. I don't know why I stumbled on that one, but anyway, it's also known as PFOA. PFOA is used in the manufacturing of Teflon. Additionally, children in the Faroe Islands experienced a decrease in the effectiveness of vaccines, and that effectiveness decrease was linked to perfluorinated compounds like PFOA. 2011 was officially the 9th or the 11th hottest year on record. It depends on whose data you're looking at. NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies reports the hotter result, whereas the National Oceanographic Association America and the UK's Met Office both place 2011 at number 11. For hotness. All agree that La Nina contributed to a brief and likely to change in 2012 cooling period. A report from the United Nations Environment Program suggested cleaning up the oceans to boost the world economy. More than 40% of the world's population lives within 100 kilometers of a coast and could directly and indirectly benefit from cleanup actions, potentially adding up to $50 billion a year to the world economy. The UK is poised to become the first country to allow research involving nuclear transfer between human reproductive cells, essentially in order to develop techniques to combine genes from more than two parental genomes. On January 19th, the UK's Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority and the Wellcome Trust announced a public consultation on the subject and a promise of funding for preclinical research, respectively. It might sound slightly like a step toward a Gattaca-like future, but it is also a step toward defeating diseases like muscular dystrophy. Microbiologist and open science proponent Rosie Redfield published data on her blog, rrresearch.fieldofscience.com, that refutes the finding of arsenic-based life by a team, including NASA scientists. The team responded that they will wait for the study to be published in a peer-reviewed journal before engaging in further discussion. Indiana's Senate Bill 89 passed committee and, if enacted, would require school districts to, quote, require the teaching of various theories concerning the origin of life, including creation science. that's not necessarily good news. A 60-day moratorium on the development of highly contagious H5N1 avian influenza was announced in the journals Science and Nature. The researchers are seeking only an opportunity to, quote, explain the benefits of this important research and the measures taken to minimize its possible risks, thereby educating benighted policymakers and the public, eliminating their perceived fear. We'll see if 60 days is enough time to do that. Who knows? Researcher David Nutt published a study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, finding that psilocybin, the active chemical in hallucinogenic mushrooms, decreases brain activity in areas of the brain with the densest connections to other areas. The paper suggests that mushrooms lead to hallucinations by decreasing synchronization and connectivity within the brain. And that does it for the science headlines this week. It's time to bring in our guest. Dr. Angelique Korthals is a biomedical, biological, and forensic anthropologist. She earned her DPhil or PhD at the University of Oxford and is currently working as an assistant professor at SUNY John Jay College for Criminal Justice in New York City. And I would love to welcome you to the show, Angelique. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. It's not SUNY, by the way. It's CUNY.
CUNY.
Yes.
I've gone back and forth on that historically, where I've pronounced it correctly, and then I convince myself that I'm wrong.
No problem. One is State University, the other one is City University.
Yes. All right. So now that we've gotten my mispronunciation out of the way, let's talk about the reason that you are here. In December, I ran across a blog posting from a blog called Ask Nicola, and the blog posting described a research study that was about to come out that was just going to blow open the field of research that's currently going on related to multiple sclerosis. And you are the author of this study. You and some and your colleagues have authored a review study, a review of the literature, and come up with a completely new perspective on why, where multiple sclerosis comes from, and the possibility of different or additional avenues for treatment that might come from this. And I'm just I saw this your study and was just fascinated by the new line of thinking. And I wanted to get you on the show, and I'm so glad to have you here to be able to talk with you about, you know, where your idea came from. You know, how did you stumble upon this new way of thinking about a disease that people have been studying for years?
Right. Well, it actually came in a very roundabout way. I was studying the immune system of a 500 years old frozen body, believe it or not. That was the body of one of an Inca so-called mummy. It's a natural mummy that was found at 6,000 meters in the Andes. And part of the study that I was doing was on the immune system response to a tuberculosis infection. Yes, by the way, Incas had tuberculosis. That's another discovery that I'm telling you here. I was studying the proteins of the immune system in response to this infection, and I was noticing that there were a lot of the proteins involved and involved in the anti-inflammatory process, but also the pro-inflammatory process belonged to, or that were most expressed in the immune system, belonged to the lipid metabolism. I had also been looking for quite a bit of time at the literature on autoimmune diseases and their link to specific mutations such as CCR5 Delta 32. And it sort of all came together I really remember the day where the whole puzzle came together. It's the day where I was, it was a day in June of last year. I saw a news item in Science, in the journal Science, about one particular receptor, hepatic cell receptor called the SRB1, the scavenger receptor B1, which is responsible.
Hepatic cell, it's in the liver for people that...
The liver. They're not exclusive to the liver, but it's mainly expressed in the liver. Okay. The article had nothing to do with autoimmune diseases. It was about fertility and in women and how mice that don't have that particular receptor are infertile and grow obese. And so that was the last piece of the puzzle, because I had been looking at SRB1 for multiple sclerosis, and I started putting the puzzle together, which means that my lab looked like the Unabomber cabin for about 2 months with all the pieces of the puzzle that I had accumulating over the years from different studies on the immune system response and my observation on autoimmune disease protein response. And this whole bit of research just came together as one coherent framework, which really, it's not the link between multiple sclerosis and lipids is not a new thing. You have Roy Swank in the University of Oregon, who came up with the so-called Swank diet, who had already tied multiple sclerosis with lipids, and that's the reason why he came up with the Swank diet, which reduces saturated fat and increases good fats such as the omega-3s. Other individuals, MDs, have come up with their own lipid metabolism linked MS, if not etiology, at least a solid link, to the point where they felt comfortable to advise to their patients that they should change their diets rather than take immunomodulatory drugs. Terry Walls is a very good example of this. She's been advocating her own special diet based on her own experience. Of course, that's, you know, in statistics that's N equal one. However,
and usually that's just considered an anecdote.
It is. It's anecdotal. In her case, her diet did benefit her, since she was able to recover mobility from being in a wheelchair prior to her diet. But again, that's N equals one. So, so the link is not new. But what is new about this new framework, what is new about my paper, is that it is the first time that the whole mechanism is explained. It is explained in a very dense biochemical way. I'm sorry. You had to read the paper.
It's not just a simple pathway.
It is not. And that's been actually, I think that has been a big misconception in the comments that I have followed the publication of the paper, was that people have said, biology is not as simple as that. And I thought, you should read the paper. My explanation is not as simple as that. But it is not just a single thing, and it's a whole series of cascade effect, which start with a sort of a priming of the body, then a trigger, and then the onset of the disease.
And that's the priming and the trigger, that is an active hypothesis that people have had about the disease for a while now. Isn't that correct? That there's maybe some kind of an environmental trigger that maybe doesn't, or an illness while somebody's young, and then the body kind of remembers.
Right.
And then
right.
later on in life, the trigger re-stimulates that memory.
Correct. And that actually has been the main the main idea for the autoimmune theory or framework. The idea was that a pathogen and more likely a virus such as the Epstein-Barr virus, which is responsible for the Kissing disease, mononucleosis.
Mono.
Is actually responsible for triggering MS. And my framework does take that into account. In fact, it is part of the framework that I've proposed. It's been also another one of the misconceptions. Even though my article says MS is not a disease of the immune system still play a part in the framework that I proposed, it's just not the origin of the disease. It's just part of the mechanism after the onset or at the onset of the disease. But yes, it's been proposed that Epstein-Barr virus causes MS. Lyme disease has been also the pathogen that causes Lyme disease, Borrelia, has been proposed to be one of the triggers. The environmental factors, of course, have also been studied, such as vitamin D. And by vitamin D, it's not just the dietary vitamin D, but it's also the stimulation and the synthesis of vitamin D by the body in the presence of sunlight. Mm-hmm. So there's been a mass of studies on the effect of seasons, so seasonality and latitude linked to MS. Why? Because, of course, MS it's very easy to see when you look at an epidemiological map of where MS occurs. It occurs above the 40th meridian, so it occurs in the northern latitudes, and that is very easy to correlate with sunlight. And I take that into account in my new framework as well, both the dietary type of vitamin D that you get from fish oil, for example, which is the biggest dietary supplement, and UV. This is also part of the framework, as I explained it in the paper.
For the for the entire framework, I know looking back, there have been these separate pieces of the puzzle. You talked about it, you know, just coming together for you one day. And I know that it's the vitamin D, and you mentioned women are also more likely to get it than men above the 40th meridian. There's been a suggested link between estrogen, vitamin D, and women. And then there's also been the suggestion of genetic and viral or the environmental trigger components. How can you simply, I know it's a very dense paper, 26 pages of explanation for your publication. But can you simply describe how the pieces did finally interlock?
Yes. So it was very funny because, as a matter of fact, when I was writing the paper, I had the most horrendous time putting the pieces of the puzzle together in a coherent text, a text that followed one piece after the other, because, of course, each of these pieces are interlocked. It's very difficult to write about them in a sort of in its own bubble to make it into a text that's understandable even by myself. I tell you that at the end of the first draft of that paper, I didn't understand myself, and I thought I have to go back to the drawing board.
I lost it somewhere. Yes. Let's start over. Yeah.
Well, yes, it was just so complex that it was very, very difficult to get. So I literally cut it and pasted the paper with a pair of scissors and tape, and put the pieces that were all over the place back together and made it into a coherent text. So the simple explanation came into one figure, which is a central figure of the paper that really gel things together, which is, I think in the paper is figure 4, which has sort of a cascade of events that lead to a loop, which is the loop of the disease itself. So what happens is, you have a combination of environmental factors, which are vitamin D, living in a northern latitude, possibly access to sunlight, of course, diet rich in saturated fats or carbohydrates. And by carbohydrates, I really mean the biggest culprits in there are sugars and refined sugars, in particular from processed food, combined with some genetic predisposition, or not. It can. I believe that autoimmune diseases don't necessarily require genetic disposition. They can occur de novo, sort of, without a genetic disposition. But it's very very clear for the populations that have been affected historically by MS that genetics has played a role, because you can see it in families. Generally, when parents are affected by multiple sclerosis, either the children or their children will be affected by multiple sclerosis. So there is a genetic component to it. From that set of factors, the environmental and the genetic factors, you get a dysfunction of the metabolism of lipids, which synthesize a toxic kind of lipid, which we call the oxidized LDL. Now, LDL is the low-density lipoprotein. That's the bad cholesterol. That's the one that you always have to watch. If your levels of LDLs are bad, time to cut the croissants out of your diet, which was my case, by the way. That bad cholesterol oxidizes. So the more LDL you have, the more potential oxidized LDL you get. And because the sets of environmental factors and genetic predisposition are what they are, your body is unable to cope with it. And that excess of OXLDL gets eaten up by the immune cells that are on the other side of the blood vessel wall for the central nervous system, or in the inner layer of artery walls when it's outside of the central nervous system. In those immune system cells gorge on OXLDL. But normally, these cells would either be emptied out by HDL, and that's the good cholesterol, the one you want to have more of. The good cholesterol will come in and eat away that that excess OXLDL from the macrophage, and things would be hanky-dory.
Right, it's kind of a secondary cleanup system that comes
exactly.
along.
It's a secondary cleanup system. It's called the cholesterol efflux system. And there's many other little steps to finally clear HDL from that toxic substance. In MS, you don't get that cleanup. That cleanup doesn't happen. And so you have this macrophage filled with that toxic substance, unable to cope, but also, and we were talking of zombies before, that's a perfect segue, also not dying.
Right. Okay. So there are these big bloated macrophages that can't really do their job anymore because they've filled up so much on the bad LDL and they're toxic, but they're also not... Nothing's getting rid of them. They're not dying. They're hanging around.
That's right.
So they're just going to start gumming up the works.
Exactly. They start literally accumulating as a plaque. And that's the lesion of MS patients, right? And that plaque become highly toxic because those macrophages start releasing what we call the reactive oxygen species, which are highly corrosive chemicals that are the signals of cells in distress. And that is one of the mechanisms by which the myelin sheath of the axonal neurons gets damaged and the onset of MS starts. When that inflammation starts, there are specific, what I would call switches that regulates the anti-inflammatory response. But because of the environmental factor and the genetic predisposition of MS patients, those switches cannot be switched on. Or they're switched on, but just halfway. So the kind of like modulator switches. Those switches are called the PPARs, the peroxisome proliferator activated receptors. They actually have a regulatory function whereby they tell the cells what particular protein to synthesize to stop inflammation. Now, the amazing thing about those switches is that those switch regulate not just the immune system and the anti-inflammatory response, but they are also the central switches of the lipid metabolism.
Okay.
And so they're really at the center between the immune system and the lipid metabolism. So when those switches are dysfunctional, they can't, they cannot hold off the inflammation. And the worst of it is that those switches are activated by actually the levels of lipids. High levels of OXLDLs and high level of saturated lipids of very long chains of fatty acids will disable those switches. So you can see how it's sort of a vicious circle now that we're entering into, because from the environment, you're getting more saturated fat, you're getting dysfunctional process of steroids or vitamin D, which are also fat soluble. You have genetic predisposition. You may have genetic predisposition, which also alters either the switches themselves or the elements that the switches regulate. And because the lipid metabolism is dysfunctional, more of those things that make those switches go awry actually are synthesized by the body and make them even more dysfunctional.
So it just is this cascade that gets worse and worse and worse, and the buildup continues.
Exactly.
Unless, of course, you're able to either change the dietary aspects of which would affect the lipid environment, or go in and change your genetics. You know, that's the easy part, right?
Yes, right. That's actually one of the it's a very good it's actually an excellent remark, because that was one that's one of the conclusion jumping that I've had to temper a lot when the paper came out, whereby diet will just solve the case. Well, not really. It might be that for some people, they can diet as much as they want. It won't have any effect because they have the genetics behind them.
And because because it's been triggered already, the diet isn't necessarily going to decrease what is already in process.
Right. And of course, a diet is never a bad thing. And there are definitely ingredients that will trigger more inflammation, whether or not you have MS, by the way. Saturated fats, no matter what you do, are still not a very good thing to ingest in a large amount. Neither are refined sugar. But in the case of MS patients, it's very important that the approach to the disease has to be a sort of a patient-to-patient approach, a sort of personalized medicine approach for that particular patient. And that's one of the most important ways that's one of the most important points that I wanted to convey about this paper, is that the cure is not here right now, and the cure is not just the diet. For some patient, it will, as I said, it might not work. It's very important that every MS patient talk with their own doctor about their own case, because each patient in terms of metabolism is very different. I mean, you have people with hypercholesterolemia, for example, which is high cholesterol, cannot control the cholesterol just by dieting. Dieting helps, but they need drugs to lower their cholesterol, like statins, for example, or agonists.
And are statins, do statins play into, say, looking at maybe your paper and the mechanisms that you've put together as a mm-hmm. model? Do you know diet and statins, current medications that we have on the market, play into the treatment strategies?
Well, there has been clinical trial for statins. There's been a series of clinical trials for statins and MS. Some of them have been promising. A couple of them have been completely not at all promising, have been complete duds. And statins are not benign drugs. I know a lot of people take it in the U.S. because a lot of people have problem with hypercholesterol, but they have serious secondary effects and they're not to be taken lightly. So it's for sure they have shown some promise, but they would only act on one bit of the framework that I've explained. So taking statin alone would not be the answer to the problem.
Right. For the entire reception of this paper, putting it forward, you at the beginning of the show, you said how this your study of this came out of archaeological forensic work, studying immune systems of long dead Incan mummies. You're not known as an MS researcher. How has it been received by the multiple sclerosis research community?
Well, it's hard to tell right now because, I've had quite a few people from the MS community write to me and challenge the paper. But I haven't had anybody yet telling me this is complete rubbish and why did you write this? Unless this is the new technique of the neurobiology world to sort of black out the potential controversial study, but right. I really haven't had a vociferous, horrid review or criticism about the paper itself. I've had parts of the paper criticized. Mainly, I found out whenever I've been trying very diligently to reply to everybody and also to. To go on blogs from DMS societies whenever patients would be asking questions and MDs would be posting their comments about the paper, about explaining things that either they didn't understand or they saw as missing in the paper. The main negative comments that I got were really centered around, but it's very clear that vitamin D has a role in diseases and in autoimmune diseases. I don't see that anywhere in the paper. Well, actually, there's an entire section of the paper that deals with this. And it specifically goes into great details about why I reconfirm the link of MS with both UV-linked vitamin D and dietary vitamin D. Another big one was, you didn't explain the disease trigger or the pathogen trigger of MS. Well, again, there's an entire section that deals with that. It's true that I mentioned Epstein-Barr probably twice in the paper, but I mention it as saying it doesn't matter what pathogen it is to a certain extent, although the trigger to the disease would preferentially be a virus because of the affinity of the macrophage receptors to lock in with viruses such as EBV, so that's Epstein-Barr virus, or herpes virus, or even the hepatitis virus, which has been linked to multiple sclerosis as well. So what I'm explaining is, yes, there is. I'm actually reconfirming the link to the pathogen trigger, saying yes, absolutely, the pathogen have got to be the trigger, but it doesn't have to be a particular pathogen, which
there could be any number.
To a certain extent, that's kind of bad news because that means that you have more possibility of triggering the disease. And I include into the trigger not just pathogen, but also trauma, which disturbs also the lipid metabolism, because when you have a severe trauma, you have cell repair. And cell repair is very much regulated by the lipid metabolism, or at least by agents of the lipid metabolism, particularly those switches that I was talking about earlier, those PPAR switches, which are very much involved into that process.
It seems, and the trigger aspect, the fact that it could be any number of triggers, and you said it is kind of bad news, it makes it very difficult, aside from knowing that you have a genetic predisposition to multiple sclerosis and to just kind of be on the lookout, it doesn't really give the average person much to go on, or even a doctor to go on to say, this person is more likely to get it, this person is less likely.
Right, right. And I think a great part of... great part missing in this paper, which is actually the subject of my second paper, the following paper that I'm writing right now, is the genetics of of this framework. And the genetics of the framework, if I thought this one was hard to write, the second one is it's actually aging me.
you see the wrinkles forming.
Yes, it's just, it's extremely complex because it's not just one factor. Now, there's one big factor that has, there's one big genetic marker that has been associated with MS, which is the a mutation in the major histocompatible region complex of the human genome, which is, of course, the region of the human genome which is responsible for the immune system. Now, that particular mutation is called the HLA-DRB1-1501. I know. Isn't that ridiculous to remember this?
It's like a phone number.
Right. And so that has been linked with MS through genome scans of MS patients throughout the world. But some MS patients have actually not been found to have that particular mutation. The great majority has, but in some MS patients, it doesn't seem to play a role. That's part of the reason why I thought I need to find a new framework that takes that confusing fact into account. That particular mutation is responsible for ligating the macrophage to specific types of for ligating two different type of immune system cells. One is called the CD4 helper T cells, and the other one is any other type of antigen presenting cells, either another immune system cells or a pathogen. Mm-hmm. So it helps sort of ligating two different cells. And that could have, in the frameworks that I'm presenting here, that can be included, and that's also part of the paper. But this, it's obvious that it's not the only genetic factor. And what we have here is a pleiotropy. And a pleiotropy is, you want to explain what a pleiotropy is?
It's where you have a number of alleles that are responsible, or sort of gene variants that are responsible at the same time for a particular trait.
Exactly. And that's exactly what I think MS is. And that's the reason why it makes it even more complex to pin down, of course.
Yeah.
And so right now I'm going through every single mutation that has been
linked to it.
Links through genome scans, so the latest genome scans to MS, and reviewing them, also thinking of the areas of the genomes where the proteins that I've encountered in my frameworks also are, to see if there could be a linkage between those alleles, to see if those mutations, for example, travel together.
Right. Right, if they always occur together. In thinking about how all this fits together and how people can use this information, how do we, take this framework that you've put together? There's somebody in the chat room who said, "Well, you're just developing a model at this point. There's still too much that's not understood." What you've put together is based on research that has taken place, but what are the next steps for researchers to take advantage of what you've written?
Next step is test the hell out of these hypotheses. just try to destroy every single bit of this this loop that I've created, this framework that I've put together. In fact, I don't know if you can show that particular figure, which is a figure four in the paper, which comes sort of in the middle of the paper. Take every bit. I have it on my desk.
Does it show the loop?
It does. Yes.
Yeah. I think Ask Nicola had put a reproduction of that on her.
Correct.
Lipid hypothesis. So there's a link, asknicola.blogspot.com, under huge news, multiple sclerosis is. There we go. In the blog, she's got that there. I think the paper link that I put in our show notes doesn't show that figure, unfortunately.
No, it's the next one over. But in any case, what I want the scientific community to do is to take that and destroy it.
Do their best to destroy it.
Exactly. Yeah. Try to destroy it. And if, while this is being done, if they can't destroy it, then the hypothesis holds and we can move on. My biggest hope is that if we move but an inch towards a possible cure, then I've done my job. It's just trying to get the scientific community to start thinking out of the autoimmune box, which I don't think is the right kind of framework to think under.
Right. As a framework, the immune system is definitely involved, but it's not the only piece of the puzzle. There's the lipid piece, the genetic piece, the environment, that everything fits together. So thinking about your hypothesis and this loop, basically what you, when you say break it, you want scientists to be able to, if you say that the deficient PPARs are these switches are responsible, you want them to show that active PPARs may have a role in it. So just try and disprove different parts of the cycle. And if they can't do it,
if they can't do it, then it holds. I mean, it's exactly like trying to disprove the theory of evolution, which scientists have been trying to do since, the 19th century. And so far, it's held its own. That's the point of science, is that I have a hypothesis, and that's also the point of me writing this big hypothesis-based article rather than publish a thousand empirical data-based studies. Is here's my hypothesis, you guys. Go ahead and test every single bit that I've described in here. And there's very simple ways to do that. I mean, I've actually put together a grant to the NIH to test part of my hypotheses. But what I really want is other labs, better established labs, labs with hundreds of people in it, to also take it apart and test every single bit of that hypothesis. And I'll applaud anybody who tells me, well, you were wrong here and here and here, because that's the point of science, right?
In terms of this, you know, this is specifically related to multiple sclerosis, but a multiple sclerosis has been, as an autoimmune disease, kind of lumped in with rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, many other autoimmune-based diseases. Do you see this hypothesis having bearing on those diseases as well, or are you specifically just looking at MS here?
Yes, I do. However, I have concentrated on multiple sclerosis, so I don't want to overstep my boundaries here. So I think there's definitely something into it. Any inflammatory-based disease probably has a similar pathway, but so far I've only been describing multiple sclerosis, and I'll keep on that particular disease.
And we're coming to the end of the hour. I'd love to find out, you know, you mentioned early. I know it goes very quickly. You asked how many talks the whole hour, and here we are.
I forgot it was 25 pages.
That's right. 25 pages of conversation, less than an hour. Go. You mentioned that the take home for the study also is that you don't want people just to jump on the idea that, you know, diet is going to fix them if they have multiple sclerosis. Do you have, you know, from your seat as a scientist, having looked at this long and hard, do you have any take-home message for patients who have been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis at this point?
Yes, the jumping to conclusion, jumping to dieting is not going to automatically fix them, that's for sure. But however, having a diet that reduces potential inflammation, such as I'm not telling you to cut out steak altogether, but maybe you should have steak only once every 2 weeks, something like that. The saturated fat and the refined sugar from the diet is not something that's tremendously difficult to achieve, and that's beneficial even outside of the framework of multiple sclerosis. The diet in itself would definitely do no harm. But the take-home message is stay tuned, because if this takes on, this could really change the way people start thinking, researcher and medical doctors start thinking about treatment of MS. And this could bring about a new era if not curing, at least treating this chronic disease, and try to prevent relapses and prevent disability from occurring.
I think that's really exciting. I think it's very exciting. And it's been really great talking with you about your paper and about the ideas that you've put together. And next time I get you on the show, we'll have to talk about ink and mummies.
Okay, well, stay tuned for that too. Yes.
Yeah, looking at your lab and the things that you do, I find it fascinating that you've taken immunology and the biology of humans across different ages to be able to come up with just such a really, really promising idea that could help people now. I think it just, to me, I just think pulling everything together, it's just such, got to be such a fascinating world you live in.
It is. It's been tremendously difficult, but tremendously exhilarating to finally see this, all these pieces of the puzzle come together. The day I just put the last piece of that puzzle together was the most nerve-wracking and exhilarating day of my life. And it's funny because I was in an IMAX movie called Mummy's Secrets of the Pharaoh. And yeah. The end of the movie is actually pithy to this particular paper, although at the time I was just starting my research on the ecology of infectious diseases. The end of the film says, well, maybe the mummies will fulfill their mission, which is to help other generation live better. Huh. To a certain extent, they kind of have fulfilled that.
Yeah, absolutely. They absolutely have. I think that, it's just very exciting. It's very neat. And I just have to know, when you put the last pieces together, finally, it wasn't like in the shower or was it in a dream? Very often we hear about scientists when they come up with their big ideas that it's, you know, often when they're doing something else that's maybe not focusing on the problem.
Well,
that epiphany moment.
I won't lie to you because this is too funny to say, but I was being a couch potato that morning. And I was quite gleefully going on my Facebook, which I receive the news feed from Science and Nature and PNAS. Right. I know my Facebook is incredibly nerdy.
So is mine. I understand.
Yes. And that one caught my eye. That one study caught my eye. And when I read the paper, which I did immediately, I looked at my partner, who is an evolutionary biologist and with whom, you know, I don't only share my life, but I share all my ideas. And I said, by Jove, I got it. I think I have the last piece of the puzzle. I told her, I said, this is it. This is the article I was waiting for. And,
wow.
And she said, well, what are you waiting for? Right, damn you.
Get off Facebook. Get back to work.
Exactly. And
stop your Facebooking.
Yes, yes. And then for 3 weeks, I frantically wrote and put the first draft together, which was horrible. And then for the next 2 months, I refined the draft to a readable format. And as a matter of fact, Nicola, whose blog you were mentioning, Nicola Griffith, is actually a science fiction writer who lives in Seattle, was my was in part my editor. My first editor, of course, is my partner who crushed my ego. And
as any good partner should, right?
Exactly. Crushed my spirit. And yet.
Thank you. I love you.
Yes. And she's so right. She was so right at every step of the way. But then when we got to a format which could be read by another human being, then I sent it to my friend, Nicola, and to make it even more readable. And this is a version that you have. It was the fruit of many people writing and editing. And it was also, of course, I was greatly helped by my academic mentors, John Ullman at Caltech and Dan Dijkhuizen at Stony Brook University, SUNY.
SUNY, not CUNY.
Right? Not yes. CUNY.
we come full circle.
That's right. I told you. Who is actually the editor-in-chief of the Quarterly Review of Biology and gave me this tremendous opportunity to publish this paper, which is very lengthy, and so it's very difficult to find a venue for this kind of paper. And I'm very happy that the Quarterly, which is a pretty prestigious biology journal, accepted it through Daniel Dyckhausen, who's really been incredible. And has been very supportive.
Well, it's great, and I just from the media reception that people are out talking about it. You know, I hope that a lot of people who are involved in multiple sclerosis research read it, and like you said, try and break it.
Yes, go ahead, try and break it, and you'll make my day if you break it. You'll make my day if you can't break it.
That's funny. Science make my
science.
Day.
It does.
Good. All right. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Korthals. It's been wonderful speaking with you. And I just, I can't wait to hear more about the research.
Well, thank you very much for having me. And you're doing a great job with your show. It's really an amazing place to discuss science.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Anybody who is interested in reading the 26 long pages of dense biology, immunology related to multiple sclerosis, you can go to the Quarterly Journal of Biology. There's a jstor.org is where you can find the link. You can go to Angelique's website, aspkorthals.net/site/lab/page.html. We will have a link available in the show notes, and that's where you can go for more information. Just do a search for Angelique Korthals if you can't remember the web address, and you'll find more information. I'm Dr. Kiki Sanford, and this has been Dr. Kiki Science Hour. Next week, we're going to be hopefully talking about some brainy science, the future of reading your mind. That's right. Can scientists read your mind? Well, we'll talk with some researchers who are working on that kind of a problem, hopefully next week. Still trying to confirm it, but that's where I'm going with it. Until then, you can follow my sciencey pursuits over on Twitter. I'm Dr. Kiki. Facebook, I'm Dr. Kiki. Google+, Kiki Sanford. And you can go to my website, drkiki.tv. You can email me at drkiki@drkiki.tv. If you want to see past episodes of this program or even see this episode again, find episodes at twit.tv/kiki. And I think that's about it. I will see you next week. Remember, all I ask is 1 hour of a week, every week for getting dirty with deep science conversations. And remember, that 1 hour a week, I hope it makes your world a whole lot more interesting. Until next week, it's time for your science meditation from this week.
Hello, Kivio.
Hello, Kim. How are you?
I'm fine. Let's see some objects.
Starting object recognizer mode. I am ready to recognize objects.
What is this?
Let me see it. I got it. I think it is Pegram.
Why don't you take a look around?
Okay. Oh.
Who is this?
Let me see. I don't know.
This is you, QBO.
Oh, let me see how I look. Now I get a picture of how I look, I will train myself. Blah. I'm ready to recognize myself.
Who is this?
Let me see. Oh, this is me. Nice.
Oh, this is me. Nice. Is this something you learned? I don't know. Here's QBO meeting somebody else.
Let me see.
QBO meets another QBO.
It looks like a QBO. Let me check who he is. Oh, it's another QBO. Hi there. What is your old name?
My name is John234, and what is yours?
My name is Daniel123. You're very good looking.
There you go.
I must say that your face sounds familiar.
Your face sounds familiar. I think I'm use that.
I like robot talk.
Well, I won't keep you any longer. I hope you have a really great evening and have fun teaching tomorrow.
Yay.
So, you know, your lightsaber and, you know, threaten students.
I do. I you know, it works very well, particularly when I play the Darth Vader. I know, right?
That's a nice one.
Oh, yeah, nice. Yeah. It's a kind of a real kind of one.
Yeah.
Quality.
I won't tell you how much I paid for this. That's why I keep it in my office away from my partner, who doesn't know I have one. Oh, wait, you're watching the program?
You blew it.
Spoiled the game. Spoiled the game. Oh.
That was awesome.
Yes.
Cover load. Oh, well. Yeah. Now your partner's going to say, wait a minute. I want
That's
to-
where the money went. We haven't been eating this month.
Top ramen because you wanted a lightsaber.
Well, you have to get another one so you can battle.
Oh, no. Yeah. My colleagues have another one.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah.
So we have, we call it the cool corridor. So I have four colleagues in this corridor and all four have a lightsaber. So when you come at the right time, hold on.
Are they going?
Hey, Jeez. Girls, can you come with your lightsaber?
We need to get those for the studio.
No, come with lightsabers.
Just one, whatever.
Just one? You have more than two? Oh. Uh-huh. That's awesome.
Science saber battles.
Yep. It's very important at the end of the semester when we have to grade, 180 exams.
Yeah.
Stress relief.